Hello, I'm Jamie Robinson. I'm professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. I work on the economics of healthcare and healthcare technology and innovation. And I have a particular interest in the system in the United Kingdom and England for various reasons. But one is that England has always had a very strong life sciences, university, and innovation system, yet it also has a single payer and single provider delivery system, the National Health Service. And those, in principle, if they, to the extent that they work together, can really be a powerful development and adoption of innovation. And so I am very pleased to do this podcast with Penny Dash, who was with us at the at our October meeting and leads one of the most important what we call integrated care systems in London and in all of Britain. So Penny, why don't you introduce yourself and then we'll roll.
Thank you, Jamie. Hello, everyone. My name is Penny Dash. As Jamie said, I'm Chair of Northwest London Integrated Care System. That essentially brings together all of the health providers within a geography. So we cover a population of around 2.7 million people. We have four acute trusts, which comprise 12 hospital sites. We have four community and mental health trusts, and we have about 350 GPs. So that just gives you a bit of a sense, as well as a number of academic partners, which we'll come on and talk about. I have been in this role formally now for 18 months, informally for about 3 years. So there was a bit of a warm-up phase when I was gradually getting involved. And my background is pretty much all healthcare. I started off as a doctor, spent most of my career working in consulting, and did have a short amount of time working for central government here in the UK at the Department of Health.
Great. Well, let's start with for the American audience, tell us about integrated care structures and systems and the board and your what is sort of the goals of it, and because it is sort of intermediate, it is not the whole country, yet it's not a small, it's a mid-size, if I may use that language, and it's big enough to be able to do stuff, but ideally small enough to be accountable to the community and to be able to focus on the particular issues of Northwest London in this case.
So the concept of an integrated care system here in the UK is not really like anywhere else. So I should have said I also spent some time working with Kaiser Permanente. I've spent some time in California, and I've looked quite a lot at different healthcare systems around the world. And this isn't like anything else. So for whatever reason, we decided to come up with a slightly different version, which might have some benefits, but I think is at the moment is causing some governance challenges, which I will allude to. But here in Northwest London, we've got good relationships, and that's allowed us to find a way forward. But why is it a bit different than anywhere else? So the first is we tried to a degree to integrate payer and provider functions. So essentially, the Integrated Care Board is the payer. So we receive £6 billion a year to cover that 2.7 million population. And we are then responsible for essentially allocating that money out, though with quite a strong direction from the centre. As part of our integration of payers and providers, though, the providers all sit around the table with us. So we develop our strategic plan. We think through where we're going to allocate the money. We think through what should services look like in conjunction with our local providers. So that's one bit of integration. The second bit of integration is that we are very much trying to integrate primary community and mental health services at the local level. So we have divided our patch up into eight areas, which are aligned with boroughs, as they're called in London. So you have things like the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea, or you have the Borough of Hillingdon, or the Borough of Hounslow, which is where Heathrow Airport is. And so those boroughs, we've put in place joint teams responsible for primary care, community care, and mental health care. And we are then very much encouraging integration with the acute sector, so bringing in specialists to support pain management or to support gynecology or to support cardiovascular health, and so on. So the second bit of integration is that integrating across the healthcare services. And then the third bit of integration is that we are encouraged, though it's only an encouragement, to work very closely with our local authority colleagues. And the local authorities are responsible for things like roads, access to green space for the schools, for environmental policies. So in theory, they could restrict things like fast food chains and so on. But they are also responsible for social care, which is essentially providing support for people with activities of daily living, like getting dressed and eating and so on and so forth. And so we are encouraged to work more closely with them, but we are not formally integrated with them. And therein is quite a significant challenge. But those are, so this term integrated care system actually picks up all three of those elements.
Yes, and you made the analogy a little bit differences with Kaiser out here on the West Coast where I am. Kaiser's very prominent, but it is different in that it's just one of systems. It's competing with other systems, and it is really pretty focused on acute care. It doesn't have its remit to include all the social determinants. It talks about that and likes to do a little bit, but it's really not funded to work on housing and education and things of that nature. This is really a great, if I may say so, a great vision of bringing all this together. And but we also hear of all the stresses on the NHS, really years of underinvestment, and then the COVID pandemic. And so now the workforce, the doctors, nurses, and others, really are stressed. And what is their, if I may say so, sort of absorptive capacity to take on these, broader, very, very wonderful, but still kind of new responsibilities?
Yeah. Well, let's start by looking at the workforce. So the workforce is definitely stressed, and one can pick that up. There's an awful lot in the press. You hear an awful lot about people saying, it's a difficult environment. We have a bit of a challenge in that the data does not substantiate that. So over the last 3 years, basically during COVID, the government put a lot of extra money into the healthcare system, into the NHS. And that has flown through largely into the workforce. So as a result, there has been an increase across the whole country, including in this patch, of around 12 to 13%. And that is whole-time equivalents, and that is primarily doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and so on. At the same time, the activity, the difference how much are we doing now versus before COVID, is down by about 4 or 5%.
You mean by patient visits? Is that what you mean by activity?
Yeah. So, and that's looking at several things. Primary care is a slightly different picture, but if we looked at community services, so that's nurses in the community doing things like wound dressing, if we look at mental health care, both of those have got fewer contacts now per whole time equivalent, has gone down by that about 15%. And if we look in the acute sector in our hospitals, A&E attendances are down, emergency admissions to hospital are down. So we've got this quite interesting picture of, and then in terms of elective care, that's also down. And as a result, we've got waiting lists which are going up. So we've in this bit of a dilemma, really, in that staff say we're completely stressed, we're exhausted, and so on, but the numbers don't substantiate that. So there is quite a lot of work going on at the moment to try and understand it. And where that analysis has got to is there is a little bit of activity that isn't being counted. So in particular, that would be something like virtual wards, which we've set up in hospitals where people can be monitored from home. But the numbers are tiny. I mean, that perhaps, that closes that gap of sort of 15% by probably 0.5%. The second issue is that definitely there's been since COVID a loss of goodwill. So where people might have stayed on and done a few extra hours and so on, the sense is that they are no longer doing that. So that has definitely had an impact. The third is that this big slug of extra money into the system led to a rapid recruitment of lots and lots and lots of more staff. But of course, that then means you've got less experienced staff, people less used to working effectively as teams, and so on and so forth. And there's a bit about taking time for those staff to come through. And then the final bit is that there's a bit of a narrative going on here, you know, that of course, during COVID, there was an awful lot about it's horrendous at the front line, and it clearly was for the people in A&E and in critical care and so on. And that has a little bit played through to it's a bit horrendous. So we are in this quite difficult position where a lot more money has gone in. The UK is now, you know, pretty much up there. I mean, obviously not with the US, but, you know, with other European countries, we're putting a similar amount of GDP in. We've got, you know, analogous numbers of staff, if not a bit higher in some places. Staff salaries, comp is actually pretty good compared to our European neighbours, and yet we've got this very high level of disillusionment. So that's a really big challenge for us. And as you say, to then try and introduce changes to ways of working and so on at that same time, is not straightforward.
Yes, it's almost like us. You can ask President Biden, you know, the US economy is going well, but you ask the average person, oh no, it's terrible. Inflation is down. People think, oh, inflation is terrible. You know,
Exactly.
so, but it's real. I mean, it's a real perception and it does influence what you can do. Switching topics slightly, although we'll stay on this to some extent, is the Northwest London ICS Trust. I mean, you have Imperial College. The Imperial College Trust, massive academic medical center, a lot of research going on, the Paddington partnership up there. And how does the ICS connect to that, let's call it the innovation enterprise in particular, and build on that?
So, not as well as we could or should, but we are trying. So, I've literally just come off a meeting. So, we've set up, it's called the Research and Innovation Program. It is chaired by lead for our Academic Health Sciences Centre, which essentially those were established probably about 10 years ago to, in a geography, bring together the various academic partners. So we have Imperial, obviously a very big university. We've also got Brunel, which is a bit less known, but focused on science and technology, just being given permission to open a new medical school. So we've got those academic partners, and the dean of those essentially then co-chairs this program board we've got. We also then have organizations called Academic Health Services Networks. The language is all very confusing. And we have one of those in the patch, and their remit is to very much work with industry to identify new innovations. So that could be medical interventions, it could be health tech, and so on. It could be digital innovations, and so on. And to really help them come into the system to set up trials, evaluations, and so on to look how they're working. So we've put those two groups together. We've then added in local primary care physicians, people from the hospitals, mental health trusts, and so on, as well as us as the kind of strategic payer, strategic organizer. And we're very much trying to say, let's align our research agenda, our innovation agenda with our population health needs, with our health services, and so on. So that's one bit that we're doing, trying to get much more aligned. So we have agreed three big programs of work for this year, of which one, for example, is trying to reduce cardiovascular. Or trying to improve cardiovascular health and reduce strokes and heart attacks by 25% over the next 4 or 5 years by using new sorts of technology, like, you know, bits of kit you can put on your chest and rapidly gives you a readout of your heart rate or an ECG and so on. We've got teams out in the community trying to measure everyone's blood pressure and bring people in to treat them better and so on. So we're doing a whole host of things, some very techie based, some much more pragmatic, but across all of that, then trying to evaluate it. So that's one set of things that we're doing. The second set, which is, you know, where you're alluding to around Paddington Life Sciences, and we have a big development at White City, which is another area, both of these very much Imperial led, is that we're really trying to look at how do we create win-wins here. So as we all know, you know, lots of potential of data, looking at data, particularly health data, and so on and so forth. So what we're trying to do, again, quite early days, is really trying to attract inward investment. So we want to say, here we are in Northwest London. We're in a good part of the country. We're close to Heathrow Airport, Central London, pretty dynamic local population, workforce, well-trained, well-skilled, and so on. This should be a great place for any life sciences company to come and set up shop. And we will link them in with our academic partners, and we'll link them in with our healthcare system. So we do have already in Northwest London, we were very much sort of leading edge in the country. We do have a single care record, which comprises health information from hospital, mental health, primary care, community care, and some social care data for our 2.8 million residents. And so we can then do all sorts of, research analysis, bit of AI and all the rest of it off that shared care record. So we see that as a big attraction. So we're very much trying to say, get inward investment in. That brings jobs into the area, that improves economic health, which improves physical health as well. And this has to be a bit of a win-win because we then also get access to early thinking, early interventions, early approaches, which can then also benefit the health and care system. That's the theory. We're in early days here. We've got a long way to go, but that's what we are ultimately trying to do.
Okay, you said that you had there was three things you were gonna say. What the first one was the cardiovascular initiative, the
What they're
second
doing.
Paddington,
No.
and that. And was there a
No. So,
third?
yeah, no. So those are all the things that we're doing. That the program that we've set up bringing together is doing three things. So one is cardiovascular. The second is that they are looking at flow across the system. So particularly for urgent emergency care, again, where can we use tech much more better and in a much better way? Could we offer people much easier access to advice so they don't have to go up to a hospital or an urgent care center? Can we be tracking who's going to which different clinics so we can redirect people and so on and so forth? That's the second one. And then the third one is looking at children's mental health, where we're looking at neurodiversity in particular. So, all these kids queuing up for their diagnosis of autism or ADHD, how do we get ahead of that game? Do much earlier diagnosis stuff and more support. So, that's what the program is doing. And then we've got work on these other areas that I referred to.
Okay. I am working with a couple of your colleagues there at ICL on a paper. We've been asked to write a paper for BMJ on industrial policy and adoption, and using ICL somewhat as a case for example. And the issue is, well, which of the technologies really jumps out as really interesting, if you will? And two of them have come out. I'm sort of interested in you from your perspective. One is this sickle cell gene therapy with Vertex, which has gotten, and the other was is this stethoscope adapted for heart failure. This, obviously, sickle cell gene therapy is at the absolute cutting edge of biotechnology worldwide. Maybe you could talk a little bit from an ICS and a board perspective. Where do you see that kind of a thing, its promise and its challenges?
So sickle cell is really a national success. It's great. I think it's poignant that it was developed locally because we have some of the highest prevalence of sickle cell in Northwest London. And there's always been quite a lot of interest in how do we improve treatment. So it's, not a coincidence, sort of a bit by design that was developed locally. The big challenge really is, what do we now do with this? So as a country and through our mechanisms, NICE, which essentially is National Institute of Clinical Effectiveness Reviews, products get endorsed and we then need to roll them out. So the big thing for us really in the ICS, ICB, is how do we accelerate adoption for something that's a proven technology we know will have impact and so on. But also crucially, how do we think through the cost-benefit analysis? Now, and that's then a bit unfair because we tend to say anything new that comes along, we subject to cost-benefit analysis. Anything old, we never question the cost effectiveness of it. It's been there forevermore. So, there's a whole set of things that we do that, we've been doing in healthcare for 50 years without much of an evidence base, and we don't really go and evaluate those. So that's quite an interesting one. Then we get into, well, and I'm going now slightly off, sickle cell gene therapy and so on. But again, very sort of present one for us is all of the new weight loss drugs. So again, evidence base is very good. Treat people, they rapidly lose weight, you turn around their heart failure. If we're all about improving health outcomes, it's tick, 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 tick. But are we comparing it to other interventions to support people to lose weight? Yes, we know it's highly impactful, but it's also quite expensive. Are we looking at the long-term consequences? What are some of the risks and so on? Do we have enough data and so on and so forth? But at the end of the day, again, it's been approved by NICE, so we kind of have to do it. But that then means it's probably going to be 30, 40, 50 million pounds for us in the patch, as well as additional services that inevitably will be added in. Where do we take that money from? What do we stop doing? Because the beneficial gain in reducing bariatric surgery, maybe a few years down the road. So any of these new interventions, new treatments, and so on, as almost raise as many questions as they solve. I think the big thing is we want to be ahead of the game. We want to be understanding what the potential innovations are. We want to be able to evaluate them. And then crucially, we've got to think about rollout and think about rollout in a way which is equitable and also goes beyond equity to address some of the major health inequalities challenges that we face.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting from an American perspective, because NICE, of course, is very famous worldwide as a very prominent, it's cost effectiveness unit. And it's often viewed as the thing that prevents new technologies getting on the market by saying that they're not cost effective. But within England, it is also a thing that presses local authorities to adopt, and with this mandate, and yet, which is very interesting, and also, so NICE will mandate that you offer to your patients a new therapy, but no one gives you an extra budget to do that,
No.
and that is mind, it's.
But equally, it goes two ways, just to give you another example. I mean, NICE has recently, or last year, carried out 140 or so evaluations of new digital tools. Really interesting. So, they fundamentally looked at their processes, and they found that actually the processes that we've developed for pharmaceuticals, we think we can adapt to a digital tool. So they've evaluated 140, and they've come up with sort of three or four classes of tools that they think are effective. So that includes things like some digital apps for mental health problems. And then, within each category, they've said, we think that these specific products actually seem to have the best data. So that is interesting that they're starting to do that. But then you look at that and you say, well, actually, most of these would be cost saving. They wouldn't incur costs because they're usually substituting for frontline clinical staff. So actually, we should be rejoicing these and grabbing them and adopting them really quickly. But the big but is that then means changing clinical practice. Not always straightforward. It
Right.
means changing some of the ratios of staff. A number of which are dictated to us nationally. You've got to have this many staff on this kind of award, or this many staff, and so on and so forth. It's changing public perceptions about what is healthcare and what does healthcare do, and so on and so forth. So it's quite interesting that some of these new technologies that NICE is evaluating, and the same thing says this is good, you should do it, are actually, even though they'd be cost saving, are harder to implement than some of the things that add costs, which we don't get any budget for to do. So it's, and then it all sort of comes back to this big bit about how do we look in the round and really think through and understand the whole of our £6 billion budget? Are we spending that as effectively as we could? Answer, definitely no.
That's right. Very, very interesting. So, let me see. I would like to go back, if I may, to the sickle cell, because the Medicare/Medicaid here are rolling out a new program, because the state Medicaid programs, where a lot of the sickle cell patients are enrolled, are not enthusiastically adopting this because it's so expensive. And so the issue of how to help them with that, particularly not only with the drug, but with the facilities and all of that that goes with it. How do you see something like that? It is locally developed. It is of a worldwide potential significance. How do you take it the next step from an, if I may say so, an economic perspective, so that it nourishes the British, the English life sciences industry with employment, like you say, economic health, something like that.
Well, things like the sickle cell example are actually, I'd say that's where it is a lot easier here than in the US. Because ultimately, it is one system, it's a single payer, sort of a single provider, as you said. And so, where there is something like that, and of course, it's so important because, particularly around health inequalities and so on, some of those things actually get supported nationally. So,
Right.
there's less for us to do locally. So some of these real specialist services or, real kind of leading edge new treatments and technologies do get a bit more managed nationally and get monies with them and so on and so forth. And it's also easier for us to think through, does it make sense to have one dedicated centre in Northwest London or should we have two or should we have three, and so on and so forth to look through the provision. So I'd say things like that are less of an issue for us here and a bit easier. And the same is true of sort of more complex treatment for cancer and so on and so forth, and some of the new treatments coming along. We've actually got quite good mechanisms for spreading them out across the country, thinking through what's the best way of rolling them out and implementing them. Perversely, it's the simpler things that we actually struggle with. Yeah, specialist stuff, I think we do better than the straightforward. Annoyingly.
That's interesting. And now the ICS is the there's I've heard different numbers, but are there 42 of them in England? Is that about the right
Wrong.
number?
That's correct. Yeah.
So every area is has got an ICS. They're non-overlapping geographically. Is this
That's
correct?
correct.
And then each one of them has within it. We would call an academic medical center, teaching hospitals, a university type entity, which is acute care, or not necessarily.
Not necessarily. They'd certainly have acute care. They wouldn't necessarily have a teaching hospital. So some have quite a few, particularly the ones in London. Some wouldn't have quite as many. So it's a bit. It does vary a bit, and then the size is quite different. So the smallest one covers a population of only 800,000. So they certainly don't have an academic centre and a teaching hospital. It is quite feasible slash quite likely that we will see some changes, see some consolidation inevitably.
And like back to sickle cell, would the idea be that each one would say, "Oh, I want a sickle cell delivery unit," or could you say, "No, we're going to send everybody from England, we're going to send them all to London, or just to London and Manchester, or something like that?"
So it depends a bit on what the condition is, what the local pop prevalence is and so on. But there is a group nationally that looks at these things. So a good example would be things like pediatric intensive care, where there'd be quite very specialized pediatric intensive care units, slightly less specialized pediatric intensive care units, and to a degree, it's not quite perfect, but those are mapped out across the country and meant to be relatively equal distribution.
And to your knowledge, I mean, has the sickle cell gene therapy actually been authorized by NICE? Has it gone through that, or is it still in that
I'm pretty sure it has been authorized.
Okay, but it might be
I think
still
it's
in
out there. Yeah,
the
I don't
privacy
know.
negotiation.
I don't 100% know. Have to check.
And speak to me if you're familiar with any thoughts on this. This echo stethoscope, which can be used in heart failure.
That was the one I was talking about. Yeah, that's great. I really like that. So they've got that. We've got 350 primary care practices, which is way too many, but anyway, we have got that many. And they are in 250. Amazing.
Okay.
Literally gone out
Wow.
there, taken the echo, whatever it's called, And they put it out there, and the GPs are using it, and they're collecting all the data, and they're going to evaluate it, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, it's really good. It's a great story. Well, let's see what impact it has. But, of course, that then aligns quite nicely with us having cardiovascular disease as a big priority for our wider research and innovation, as I was talking about earlier.
Right. And maybe you could contrast it, give, as long as we're talking cardiovascular, with the difficult rollout of inclisiran, where the
Yes.
GPs said, thank you, but no thank you. What's
Yeah.
different?
Exactly. Well, actually, that came up in this meeting I've just been in. What people say, as a very good friend of mine heads up the sort of research and innovation equivalent group in Manchester, in Greater Manchester, and they have had amazing rollout of inclisiran. And he
Okay.
says that's all down to they made it a priority. So they basically said, as this research and innovation group, this is our remit. Here's a product. Price has been negotiated for us nationally. We've got a good deal. It clearly works. It works very well. We are going to see it as our responsibility, our remit, to get this out into the GP practices and get them to use it. So they did that there. The conversation we were having here earlier today is that, interestingly, since we made cardiovascular health a priority and we're using the stethoscope for heart failure and so on, electronic stethoscope, actually, we've seen a big uptick in terms of the adoption of inclisiran. So the
Okay.
thesis is, the hypothesis is that, all this primary care, it's a bit subscale, it's lots of individual doctors, little groups of doctors. They're a bit settled in their ways and their ways of working, and you actually have to push pretty hard. You've got to put more resource in than perhaps we think to get them to change the care pathway, change the prescribing habit, and so on.
Interesting. And so when you say there's an uptake of inclisiran, you mean in the
Apparently.
GP practices, in the
Apparently,
GP.
yeah. Yeah,
Okay.
yeah.
Actually
Yeah.
very interesting. Yeah, that's actually very interesting.
Perhaps a bit late, but at least,
Right. Well, it was, viewed from outside, it was a great initiative. A good drug, good big unmet need. The idea of doing it in general practice and not for it to go to the hospital.
exactly.
We've had very poor in the United States experience with PCSK9 inhibitors being blocked by the health insurance plans not willing to pay for it, and it's been a real unfortunate circumstance. Okay, well, maybe we should move towards wrapping this up. What would you, given your experience, what would you see as the learnings that you've had so far in the board for the rest of the NHS, and then perhaps for the United States trying to do some of the same goals, achieve some of the same goals?
So I think the first is have a very clear sense of what you're trying to do. So that means you need to understand where you're starting from. So what's your current situation, and be quite open and honest. So in terms of, this is the health of the population, here's what we know is good, here's not good, and so on and so forth. So understand the starting point, but then have this very clear sense of what are we trying to do. So this bit about having a narrative. So we do have a pretty clear narrative that says these are the things that we are trying to fundamentally change. And crucially, back to where I started, we actually believe we've got enough resource to do it. So this isn't about saying we don't have enough money or we don't have enough this and so on. I mean, there is a bit of a capital issue, which I'll come back to. But largely, we think we've got enough money and these are the things that we need to do. So I think that is really crucial. And that is interestingly missing from a number of the other ICSs, ICBs, I would say. Then
Interesting.
what we're doing is, if having agreed on the sort of narrative and what we're trying to do, which by the way has been a very collaborative process to develop that. So we are working, with all the bits of the system, clinicians, managers, patients, populations, communities, da da da. Then, and this is the really challenging bit, we then need really clear plans and trajectories to get us there over the next 5 years.
Right.
And that's where we are, at the moment, is really trying to set out that level of detail. And we're not shying away from the fact that this is change. If we want to improve, we've got to change. You can't just do more of the same and hope that magically things improve. We need to change. So we're being quite clear on that. And these are the things. And, some bits aren't going to be popular. Of course they're not. We question whether we can deliver the kind of high quality primary care out of these tiny little falling down houses that people still use. No, we can't. We want to get specialist input and expertise out. And then we need to be quite honest as well that if we do all of these things we want to do, we need a smaller acute sector. At the moment, we spend 56, 57% of our money goes on the acute hospitals. That would be way lower if you were in one of the Nordic countries. So we should see success as we're spending less money on our hospitals, whereas many people here judge that as a failure. They want to put more and more into hospitals. So there's quite a lot here about sort of that narrative, being clear on what we're trying to do. And then the final bit is put in place. We do have, well, it's work in progress, but we have quite a clear sort of management structure, governance structure through which we're trying to enact these changes and these processes. So we're quite clear this person leads on this, this one leads on this. This is, they have an inclusive approach to who sits around the table. So those, not rocket science, but quite methodical, quite structured.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, this is very, very good. I think that this is great for today. But anyway, thank you very much. And
Very nice to
we
see you. Good luck.
thank
Take care.
you.
Thanks, Jamie. Bye.